36 others, and hoping he would be the first to break the story. The cover. A naturalist based at the University of Sussex, Craig's brief was to confirm whether or not leopards still lived wild on the island. They'd even put Sussex's professor of zoology in the picture for a consideration, of course, which they called a consultancy fee. So that if anyone called from Zanzibar to check up on Craig, they'd find him to be bona fide. That afternoon, Craig had visited the Natural History Museum, quite the bizarrest of its type in his experience. Glass cases full of birds, presumably stuffed birds, but not mounted, lying down, recently dead-looking, their little feet tied together with string, tags to identify them, their eyes dabs of chalk, in a grimy case all on its own, the bones of a dodo wired up into a standing position, a couple of stuffed bats, the American fruit bat, and the Pemba fruit bat, 10 times the size of the swallow-like creatures that had flitted about his head as he'd walked off his dinner the evening before. A crate with its lid ajar. When he opened it, a flurry of flies, one he couldn't prevent going up his nose. Inside, a board with 3 rats fixed to it. Dead again, stuffed presumably, but with legs trussed at tiny rodent ankles. No effort made to have them assume lifelike poses. No bits of twig and leaf, no glass eyes, no glass case. He dropped the crate lid. Oddest of all, row upon row of glass jars containing dead sea creatures and deformed animal fetuses. The glass furred up with dust and calcified deposits, so you had to bend down and squint to make out the bloodless remains of a stonefish, the huge crab with the image on its shell of 2 camels with their masters, the conjoined duiker antelopes, and the stuffed leopard. They hadn't done a great job on it, the taxidermist's task being to stage a magic show for eternity, the illusion of life in the cock of the head, the setting of a glassy twinkle. The Natural History Museum of Zanzibar should have been asking for their money back on this one. You could still see it was a leopard, though. If you didn't know, you'd look at it and you'd say, leopard. Craig examined it from every angle. This was what he was here to find, ostensibly. It couldn't do any harm to have a good idea what one looked like. Up on the terrace, the touts were working the crowd, slowly, carefully, with a lower key approach than they tended to use down in Stonetown. In Stonetown, the same guys would shadow you on the same streets day after day. Jumbo, they'd say. Jumbo, you'd reply, because it would be rude not to. You want to go to Prison Island? You want to go to the East Coast today? Maybe you want to go to Nungwi? You want taxi? You ran the gauntlet going up Kenyatta Street, and never had a moment's peace when you were around Jamyadi Gardens, from where the boats left for Prison Island, its coral reefs and giant tortoises. He'd read the books all right. Jumbo, the voice was close to him. Craig sneaked a look around as he necked his beer. A young Zanzibari had moved in on a blonde English girl who had been sitting alone. The girl smiled a little shyly, and the youth sat down next to her. "The sun is setting," he said, and the girl looked out over the ocean. The sun had started to dip behind the bank of cloud. "You want to go to Prison Island tomorrow?" he asked, pulling a pack of cigarettes from his pocket. The girl shook her head. "No, thanks." She was still smiling, but Craig could see she was a little nervous. Doing battle with her shyness was the adventurous spirit that had brought her this far from whichever northern market town she'd left behind. She was flattered by the youth's attentions, but could never quite forget the many warnings her worried parents would have given her in the weeks before she left. The tout went through the list, and still she politely declined. In the end, he changed tack and offered to buy her a drink. Craig heard her say she'd have a beer. The youth caught the waiter's eye and spoke to him fast in Swahili. Next time the waiter came by, he had a can of Stella for the girl and a Coke for the tout. Craig watched as the girl popped open the Stella and almost imperceptibly shifted on her seat so that her upper body was angled slightly further away from the boy in favor of the ocean. Maybe she shouldn't have accepted the beer, thought Craig. Or maybe it was old-fashioned to think like that. Perhaps these days girls had the right to accept the beer and turn the other way. He just wasn't sure the African youth would see it like that. Whether he was a practicing Muslim, the abnegation of alcohol told him that, or not. A high-pitched whine in Craig's ear, a pinprick in the forearm, he smacked his hand down hard, lifted it slowly to peer underneath. Craig started, then shuddered, never able to stand the sight of blood, whether his own or anybody else's. He had once run out of the cinema during an afternoon screening of The Shining. He had fainted at the scene of a road accident, having caught sight of a pedestrian victim's leg, her stockings sodden with her own blood. She survived unscathed. Craig's temple bore a scar to this day where he had hit his head on the pavement. The mosquito had drunk well, and not just of Craig, either. His stomach turning over, he quickly inspected the creature's dinner, which was smeared across his arm, a red blotch in the shape of Madagascar, almost an inch long. Craig wondered whose blood it was, given that the mozzie had barely had enough time to sink its needle beneath his skin. Some other drinkers? Craig looked about. Not that of the Italian in the tight briefs, he hoped. Nor, ideally, had it come from either of the two South African rugby players sitting splay-legged at the front by the railing. He spat onto a paper tissue and wiped his arm vigorously without giving it another look until he was sure it had to be clear. The energy from the slap had been used up bursting the balloon of blood. The mosquito's empty body, split but relatively intact, was stuck to Craig's arm like an empty popsicle wrapper. This bothered him less than the minutest trace of blood still inside the dead insect's glassy skin. When he looked up, the blonde girl had joined a group of Europeans, Scandinavians or Germans by the look of them, and was eagerly working her way into their telling of travelers' tales, while the young tout glared angrily at the bank of clouds obscuring the sun, his left leg vibrating like a wire. Craig hoped he wasn't angry enough to get nasty. Doubted it, after all. Chances were this sort of thing happened a lot up here. The kid couldn't expect 100% strike rate. Craig gave it 5 minutes. Then went over and sat next to the kid. Kid turned around, and Craig started talking. 10 minutes later, Craig and the kid both left, though not together. Craig was heading for Mazson's hotel and bed. The kid, his timetable for the following day sorted, having spoken to Craig, was heading home as well. Home for him being his family's crumbling apartment in the heart of the stone town, among the rats and the rubbish and the running sewage. To be fair, the authorities were tackling the sewage, but they hadn't yet got as far as the kid's block. The group that Allison, the blonde girl, had joined was approached by another tout, an older, taller fellow, more confident than the kid. Not so much driven by other motivations, less distracted. He had a job to do. With her new companions, Allison was not so nervous about getting into the trip's business. She wanted to go to Prison Island. They all did. they looked around to include her as the tout waited for an answer. And she nodded, smiling with relief. Turned out they were German, two of them, the two girls. But naturally they spoke perfect English. The third girl and the boy, who appeared to be an item, were Danish. But you wouldn't know it. Their English, spoken with American accents, was pretty good, too. "We were just in Goa," said Kristen, one of the German girls. "It is so good. Have you been?" "No," Allison shook her head. "But I'd like to go. I've heard about it." She'd heard about it all right. About the raves and the beach parties, the drugs and the boys. Australians, Americans, Europeans. It had been hard enough to get permission to come to Zanzibar, especially alone. But her parents had accepted her right to make a bid for independence. "Ach!" shouted Anna, the second German girl, flailing her bare arms as she failed to make contact with a Mozzie. "Scheiß!" "Where are you staying, Allison?" asked the Danish boy, Leif, his arm around his girlfriend's shoulder. Allison named a cheap hotel on the edge of Stonetown. "You should move into Emerson's house," Leif's girlfriend, Karen, advised. "That's where we're all staying. It's really cool. Great chocolate cake." She looked at Leif, and for some reason they sniggered. Kristen and Anna joined in, and soon they were all laughing, Allison included. Their combined laughter was so loud they couldn't hear anything else. People started to look, but leaning in towards each other, they could only hear their own laughter. Popo, the kid, picked up Craig outside Masson's at 9 the next morning, in a battered but just about roadworthy Suzuki Jeep. "Jumbo," he said as Craig climbed in beside him. "Josani Forest." "Jumbo, Josani Forest," Craig confirmed their destination. They rumbled out of town, which became gradually more ramshackle as they approached the outskirts. Popo used the horn every few seconds to clear the road of cyclists who were out in the hundreds. No one resented being ordered to make way, Craig noticed, as they would back home. Popo's deft handling took the Jeep around potholes and, where they were too big to be avoided, slowly through them. Most of the men in the streets wore long flowing white garments and skull caps. As they got further out of town, the Arabic influence became less pronounced. The women here wore brightly colored kikoi and carried unfeasibly large bags and packages on their heads. Orderly crowds of schoolgirls in white headgear and navy tunics streamed into schools that appeared to be no more than collections of outbuildings. Between the villages, banana plantations ran right up to the edge of the road. Huge bunches of green fruit pointed up to the sky. Brown raffia-like leaves cracked in the Jeep's draft. "You look for red colobus monkey?" Popo asked, without taking his eye off the road. "I told you last night," Craig reminded him. "Zanzibar leopard. I'm looking for the leopard." "No leopard here," Popo shook his head. "I heard the witch doctors keep them. No leopard." "There are witch doctors, then?" Popo didn't say anything as they passed through another tiny village. Crowds of little children too small to be in school running up to the Jeep and waving at Craig. Old men sat under a shelter made out of dried palm leaves. The children shouted after them, "Jumbo! Jumbo!" Craig waved back. "In Josani Forest," Popo said slowly, "red colobus monkey. Only here on Zanzibar." "I know," said Craig, wiping his forearm across his slippery brow. "And the leopards? The witch doctors? I have to find them. No leopard here." He wasn't going to get much more out of Popo, that was clear. When the kid swung the Jeep off the road, he reacted swiftly by grabbing his arm. But they had only pulled into the car park for the forest. He let go of the kid's arm. Sorry, took me by surprise. Popo blinked slowly. No leopard here, he repeated. The noise of the boat's engine, a constant ragged chugging, made conversation impossible. There was no point trying to make yourself heard, but that didn't stop Leif from occasionally mouthing easily understood remarks about the choppiness of the water, the heat of the sun. The others, Karen, Anna, Kristen, and Allison, grinned and nodded, although Allison's grin was a little forced. Her trip to Prison Island was already going to exact a price, even though it was only supposed to be a half-hour hop. Allison could barely walk through a puddle without getting seasick. As the 25-foot wooden craft took another dive off the top of the next crest, she lurched forward and felt her stomach do the same, only it seemed without stopping. She retched, assumed the crash position, fully expecting to be ditched in the drink. It didn't happen. The boat lumbered up the next heavy swell, perched an instant at its arete, and plummeted into the trough. Allison groaned. The two Danes were chattering excitedly in their own tongue, clearly having a ball. When she looked up, Allison saw Anna and Kristen smiling down at her. Are you okay? One of them asked, and Allison just managed to shake her head. It's not far to the island, Anna said, looking forward, but the boat pitched to port, throwing her off her feet. She tumbled into Allison's lap, Allison dry retching once again. Oh, God, she moaned. I can't stand it. It's not far now, Leif tried to reassure her, although he was puzzled as to why they had shifted around so much that the bow was now pointing out to sea. Where are we going? Anna asked, of no one in particular, once she had picked herself up off the duckboards. Now Kristen demanded, What's going on? As the bow swung around several degrees further to port. Their course could no longer be even loosely interpreted as being bound for Prison Island. Where are you taking us? She shouted at the boat's skipper. A lad no more than 18 sat in the stern, his hand on the outboard throttle. They were now heading into the wind, and spray broke over the bow every seventh or eighth wave. Allison had started to cry, tears slipping noiselessly over green cheeks. Her mouth was set in a firm, down-curved bow, her brow creased in determined abstraction. Leif rose to his feet unsteadily and asked the skipper, What's going on? The 18-year-old just stared at the horizon. We want to go to Prison Island. We paid you the money. Where are you taking us? Still the guy wouldn't look at him. Leif leaned forward to grab his arm but found himself jerked back from behind. The other African, who had been squatting in the bow, motioned to Leif that he should sit down. The fingers of his left hand were wrapped around the stubby handle of a fisherman's knife. Sit, he ordered. Sit. He looked at the girls. Sit. He pointed at the wooden bench seats, and everyone complied. Now Anna had started to weep as well, and was not so quiet about it as Allison. Hands, the boy barked, his jaw snapping around the rusty gutting blade and grabbing at Leif's wrists. With a length of twine, he quickly tied Leif's hands behind his back before any of the girls had the presence of mind to knock him off his feet while he had his hands occupied and was temporarily unarmed. They would live to regret this missed opportunity. Anna and Kristen were almost paralyzed with fear. Allison was within an ace of throwing herself overboard, believing that to actually be in the water could not be worse than being in a boat on it. Still, the boat struck out against the direction of the incoming waves, and soon they were all soaked from the spray over the bow. The boat climbed and plunged, climbed and plunged. Allison leant over the side and was quietly sick. She hoped it would make her feel better. It was funny how not even mortal fear could distract her from her seasickness. Neither, it transpired, could the act of vomiting. If anything, she felt worse, and when the boat slipped around several degrees to port and took the waves side on, she liked it even less. Each time the narrow craft leaned to either side, she thought she was going in. Again, she considered doing it deliberately. Anna and Kristen were both crying, staring alternately at each other and at Leif, who was ashen-faced. Allison justified her intention to jump ship by interpreting the others' introvertedness as being an atavistic retreat into their original social groupings in the face of extreme fear. They would no more try to save her life than they would that of one of the two kidnappers, she reasoned. How long had they known her? 12 hours? What kind of bond grew in such a short time, not a lasting one? She remembered what her mother had once told her when they'd taken the ferry to Calais. "Look at the horizon," she'd said. "Watch the land. Don't look at the water." Thinking of her mother only brought fresh tears, and looking left at the palm-fringed shoreline of the island some half-mile away made her feel no better. There was no way she would ever be able to swim such a distance, not even if her life depended on it, and seasickness had to be better than either drowning or being eaten by hammerhead sharks. She'd done her homework, and Mother Nature's bizarrest-looking fish was known to nest in several of the bays around Zanzibar. She leaned forward again in order to sneak a look at the African boy who had gone back to the bow now that Leif was tied up. And neither she nor any of the three other girls appeared to be capable of making a move against him and his mate. He appeared to be searching for something on land at the same time as casting quick little glances back at his captives. If she wasn't mistaken, Allison thought he was nervous. She wondered if they could turn that to their advantage. Maybe he was new to this game, whatever it entailed. "Listen," she addressed the others, "we've got to do something." The three girls looked up, whereas Leif retreated further inside himself. He looked as if they might have lost him. Were it not for him, they could have all jumped overboard on a given signal and helped each other to shore. But with his hands tied behind his back, Leif would be unable to swim, and the logistics of trying to drag him, life-saving style, over half a mile even between them seemed insurmountable. Karen and Anna were still crying. Kristen had stopped and was calmer. "What can we do?" she wondered.
"Hey," the boy in the bow shouted at them, brandishing his knife.
"We could all go overboard and take Leif with us," Allison whispered. "See if we can make it to the shore. Or we rush one of them, try and overpower him, knock him in, whatever. We've got to do something." "Even if we jump in, they've got the boat. They would easily catch up with us." The boat tipped suddenly as the boy from the bow skipped over the wooden cross seats toward them and, sweeping his right arm in a wide arc, connected with Kristen under her jaw, knocking her completely off balance. Allison watched in horror as Kristen teetered for a second close to the gunwale, unaware of the seventh wave about to hit the boat on the starboard side. A scarlet stripe had been drawn on her cheek by the boy's knife, which had been in his hand when he hit her. The wave smacked into the side of the boat, and she was gone in a flash, vanished.
"No!"
Allison screamed, clambering over to that side of the boat and leaning over. Kristen had been swallowed by the waves. Shock, presumably having rendered her incapable of reaction. She must have taken her first breath only after hitting the water.
You murdering bastard, you fucking— Allison leapt at the youth in her fury, but he grabbed her slender wrists and held her at bay, grinning while she struggled. She tried to kick him, but he threw her down on the bottom of the boat, where she scrambled for safety as he leaned down over her, threatening with the knife. "No more," he said. Kristen's friend Anna had clasped her arms around her knees and was rocking to and fro on her seat, moaning softly. Karen was sobbing, caught between trying to protect Allison and looking after her distracted boyfriend. When he was satisfied the threat to his and his partner's authority had diminished, the youth returned to his post in the bows, occasionally shouting remarks back to the stern in Swahili. Allison climbed back onto a seat, unable to control a violent trembling which had seized her limbs. She kept visualizing Kristen, washed up on the beach. She would appear not to be moving, then would cough up a lungful of seawater and splutter as she fought to regain control of her breathing. When the images were blacked out by another sickening swoop down the windward side of a wave, she knew that Kristen was dead. She might eventually get washed up among the mangrove swamps of southwestern Zanzibar, but her bones would have been picked clean by the hammerheads. The boat shifted around dramatically on a shout from the lookout boy. They were heading into shore. Allison doubted whether Leif would even be able to walk. Josani is the last vestige of the tropical forest that had at one time covered most of the island. The red colobus monkeys make it a tourist attraction, but the monkeys conveniently inhabit a small corner of the forest near the road, not far from one of the spice plantations. Visitors are taken out of the car park, back across the road, and down a track to where the monkeys hang out. The first monkey, Craig saw, was not remotely red. "Blue monkey," the guide said. "Over there," he pointed through the trees, "is red colobus." Craig saw a number of reddish-brown monkeys of various sizes playing around in the trees, leaping from one to another. They made quite a racket when they landed among the dry, leathery leaves.
"Great," Craig said. "What about the leopards?"
The guide gave him a blank look.
"You want to see Main Forest?"
"Yes, I want to see Main Forest." He followed the guide back to the road and into the car park. The tour around the Main Forest, Craig knew, would only scratch the surface of Josani. "My driver can guide me," Craig said, slipping a $5 bill into the guide's palm. "You stay here. Relax, put your feet up, get a beer or something." The guide looked doubtful, but Craig beckoned Popo across. He walked slowly, with a loose stride, long, baggy cotton trousers and some kind of sandals.
"Tell him it's okay," Craig said to Popo. "You can take me in."
After a moment's hesitation, Popo talked rapidly to the guide, who shrugged and walked back to the reception area defined by a bunch of easy chairs and some printed information and photographs pinned up on boards.
"Let's go, Popo."
Popo headed into the forest. They followed the path until Craig sensed they were starting to double back on themselves. He stopped, pushed his sunglasses up over his forehead, and lit a cigarette.
"I think I want to head off the path a little," he said as he offered a cigarette to Popo.
The African took a cigarette and lit it. The $100 bill folded around the pack, not lost on him.
"Do you want to take the whole pack?" Craig asked. "I have to head off the path a little way. Leopards, you know."
"No leopard here."
Popo's hand hovered in midair.
"Witch doctors, then, you interested or not?"
Craig offered him the bribe again and nodded in the direction he wanted to go. Popo took the pack of Marlboro, slipping the cash out from underneath the cellophane wrapper, and folding it into his back pocket. Then he led the way into the forest proper. After a few yards, he knelt down at the base of a tree. Craig knelt down beside him and looked where the kid was pointing. There were dozens of tiny black frogs, each no bigger than a fingertip, congregating on some of the broader fallen leaves. "Here water come," said Popo, "from sea."
"Flood water?"
"Yes. No one come here. Dangerous."
"Good. Let's go on in that case."
As soon as they hit the sandy bottom, the youth in the bow jumped out and tugged the boat up onto the beach. The kid in the stern pulled up the outboard. Three gangly, raggedy youths walked across the beach to meet them. Allison, Karen, Leif, and Anna were forced out of the boat at knife point, and the two youths exchanged a few words with the newcomers before turning their boat around and pushing off from the shore. Allison, Karen, and Anna had to walk with their hands on their heads to the tree line. Leif's hands were still tied behind his back. His face betrayed no emotion. Allison was amazed he'd been able to get up and walk. As for Allison, her legs had turned to rubber. Despite her small relief at being on dry land, their new captors were also armed and ruthless-looking. The wind blew through the tops of the palm trees, an endless, sinister rustling. But as they trooped into the forest, the palms thinned out, their place taken by sturdier vegetation. The canopy was so high it created an almost cathedral stillness. All Allison could hear now, apart from their shuffling progress through the trammeled undergrowth, were the occasional hammerings of woodpeckers and the screams of other unknown birds. From time to time, on the forest floor, she would spot seashells glimmering through the mulch. She jumped when she almost walked into a bat, only to discover it was a broad brown leaf waiting to drop from its tapering branch. She swiped at it, and when it didn't instantly fall, she went ballistic, swinging her arms at it as if it were a punch ball. The party halted, and two of the African youths came towards her, their knives at the ready. She peered over the edge of sanity at the possibility of panic, stood finally balanced, debating her options, caught between self-preservation and loyalty to the group. Before she knew what she was doing, she had taken flight. One of the youths might have taken a swing at her, the point of his knife flashing just beneath her nose. She couldn't be sure. Something had happened to spur her into action, action which she instantly regretted, mainly because it was irrevocable, and she knew she would never outrun the local boys. Also, because she had deserted her companions, which according to her own code of honor was unforgivable. Yet she couldn't be sure they wouldn't have taken the same chance. Indeed, by running, she had created a diversion which, if they had any sense, they would exploit. These thoughts flashed through her mind as she crashed through the forest, her flesh catching on twigs and bark and huge serrated leaves, yet she felt no pain. Adrenaline surged through her system. She couldn't hear her pursuers, but she knew that meant nothing. These boys would be able to fly, whatever it took to render her bid for freedom utterly futile. As soon as they heard the drumming, Popo became jittery. Craig didn't give him more than 5 minutes.
"What is it, Popo?" he asked him. "What's going on?"
"Mbo," was all he would say, his eyes darting to and fro.
"Mbo."
It was faint, still obviously some way off, but unmistakably the sound of someone drumming. It wasn't the surf, and it wasn't coconuts dropping from the palm trees. It was someone's hand beating out a rhythm on a set of skins. A couple of tom-toms, maybe more.
the kind of thing you played with your hands, sat cross-legged, whatever they were called. Craig hadn't a fucking clue. As for Popo, he was out of there. Craig didn't even watch him go, back the way they'd come. His $100 had brought him this far, which was all he'd wanted the kid to do. A mosquito whined by his ear. He brushed it away and walked on, moving slowly but carefully in the direction of the drumming. He stopped when he heard another sound, coming from over to his right. Another similar sound, but more ragged, less musical. The sound that would be made, he realized, by someone running. Craig's mind raced, imagining someone running into danger, and he was about to spring forward to intercept the runner, whom he still couldn't see, when he saw hovering in the space in front of him a whole cloud of mosquitoes. They shifted about minutely, relative to each other, like vibrating molecules, seeming at one moment to dart towards him, only to feel a restraining influence and hang back. Because of the noise of the fast-approaching runner, he couldn't hear their dreadful whine, but he imagined it. And the runner appeared, crashing her way through the trees, arms and legs flying, a young girl. The young girl from the Africa House Terrace, Craig realized, heading straight for the source of the drumming. "Hey! Stop!" Craig shouted as the swarm of mosquitoes swung its thousand-eyed head to follow the girl's progress. The whole cloud tilted and curved after the girl. She screamed as they crowded around her head. Hardly could she have announced her arrival any more extravagantly. Not that Craig had any idea who or what was responsible for the drumming, nor whether they represented a threat. He just had his instincts. The girl had a head start on him. He ran as fast as he could, but couldn't close on her. Too many long lunches in the Eagle. Too many fast food containers in the bin under his desk. His heart beat a tattoo against his chest. He thrust his arms out in front of him to catch a tree trunk and so managed to stop short as the girl burst through into a wide clearing, the mozzies still shadowing her. His hand drums lying scattered at his feet, the drummer rose to his full height, 6 foot something of skin and bone, unfolding like some med student's life-size prop. He was a white man, although it was impossible to judge his age. His feet and lower legs were bare, but the rest of him was clothed. Craig rubbed his eyes, which had started to go funny. Perhaps the heat and the exertion, the fear, maybe, which he acknowledged for the first time, his pulse scampering. The man's coat constantly shifted in and out of focus, like an image perceived through a stereogram. Either there was something in Craig's eyes obscuring his vision, or some filmy substance, spider's web or other insectile secretion, draped across the undergrowth between him and the clearing. The tall man moved closer to Allison, who shrank away from him. He peered at her with bulging eyes that indicated thyroid disorder. His coat settled organically around his coat hanger shoulders. Allison screamed and the coat shimmered. She lashed out with her right hand, drew a swath through the living, clinging coat of mosquitoes. They swarmed about her head for a moment, mingling with the swarm that had aggravated her before gravitating back to their host. The man's movements were slow. He seemed to make them reluctantly, as if he had no choice. His face was too sunken in the cheeks and uniformly white to betray any emotion. Stepping back from the girl, he picked up a long, bone-white, blood-stained instrument from the floor by his drums and strapped it over his skull. The false snout, a foot long by the look of it, wobbled hideously as he approached the girl again. The base of it,
the knuckle joint, let's face it, the thing had been fashioned from a human femur, rested against his mouth. He blew through it, a low burbling whistle, at which the mosquitoes became markedly less agitated and settled around him. Allison sank to her knees in a dead faint, and he snuffled about her prone body. Craig was furiously considering what action he could take when a further crashing through the undergrowth announced the arrival of Allison's friends from the Africa House, bound and led by three tough-looking African youths, who each mumbled what appeared to be a respectful greeting to the tall man. "Mbo," they each seemed to be saying. Leif, the Danish boy, had remained unresponsive throughout the trek from the beach. His girlfriend, Karen, was trembling with fear and continuous shock. Anna simply screamed whenever anyone came near her. Two of the youths took hold of Karen and Anna and laid them out flat on the ground, grabbing lengths of dried palm leaves. They wound them around the girl's ankles, going around and around several times, then over the loop in the other direction between the legs until they were secure. They left the arms. The third African youth swiftly bound Leif's ankles in the same manner. Craig had to strain to see where the three were taken, beyond the lean-to on the far side of the clearing. But what lay hidden there, Craig could not see. The tall, white-skinned man was still inspecting Allison when one of the youths returned and started to bind her around the ankles as well. The man sat down once more upon the ground, his legs becoming dismantled beneath his hazy coat like a pair of fishing rods being taken apart. He picked up his hand drums and began to play. Craig took advantage of the noise to retreat a few yards from the edge of the clearing back into the forest. 20 yards back, he crept around towards the back of the camp. It took him a while, because he had to move slowly to avoid alerting anyone to his presence, but he got there. Then it took him a moment before he recognized what he was seeing. Even though this was what he'd been looking for, what he'd come to Africa for. They hung from the branches of a single tree like bats. Like bats, they hung upside down. Like bats. Or like the poor creatures Craig had seen in the museum in the town, bound, each one of them at the ankles. 3 dozen, at least. Most of them were completely drained of blood, desiccated, like the Bombay duck Craig would always order with his curry just to raise a laugh. Husks swinging in the breeze. Wind-dried Bombay duck. Long hair suggested which victims were female, while bigger skeletons hinted at male. But there was no way of telling with most of the poor wretches. Nearest the ground hung the recent additions, Karen, Anna, Leif. Craig heard the tall man coming around the side of the hut before he saw him. The wind was not strong enough to drown out the whining concert of the mosquitoes the tall man wore around himself like so many familiars. His own insectile eyes protruded as he looked at his new arrivals, all strung up and ready for him. Behind him came two of the youths carrying Allison. The tall man, wearing his bone-nose flute, took a tiny step towards Anna, whose screams were torn out of her throat at his approach. I could already smell the coppery tang of blood even before the ancient ectomorph in the coat of mosquitoes prodded the young girl's throat with the sharpened femur he wore strapped to his head. Craig was ashamed at himself, but couldn't stop the opening sentences of his eyewitness account forming in his mind. I was smelling the blood he had already spilt. I must have smelled it on him or in the air, because the ground beneath my feet nourished no more exotic blooms than the surrounding forest, for he spilled no blood. This exiled European, this tall, spindly shadow of a man, scarcely a man at all, drank the blood, every last drop. It was what kept him alive. I sensed this as much as deduced it as my eye ranged across the bat-like corpses suspended from his tamarind tree. At the same time I felt a shadow fall across my heart, from which I knew I should never be free, even if I were somehow to effect an escape for myself and the youngsters who had joined the monster's collection. This was Craig's problem now. The purple prose would die a death at the hands of the paper's subs. But thinking of it in terms of the news story he had come out here to investigate helped him distance himself sufficiently to keep his mind intact, to remain alert. Whatever the odds stacked against him, he still possessed the element of surprise. While he was still thinking, racking his brains for an escape route, the tall man's head jerked forwards, driving the tip of his bone flute into the hollow depression of Anna's throat. Blood bubbled instantly around the puncture, then disappeared as it was sucked down the bone. Craig forced his eyes shut, fighting his own terror of spilt blood, but he had heard the man's first swallow, his greedy gargle as he tried to accommodate too much at once. Craig had always believed himself the hard man of investigative journalism, hard to reach emotionally. His bed back home never slept two for more than one night at a time, and impossible to shock. His fear of the sight of blood had never been a problem before. He avoided stories which trailed bloody skirts. Car wrecks and shootouts, not his style. As he retched and tumbled forwards out of the concealing forest, he knew this was a story to which he would never append his byline. Firstly, because he wasn't going to get out alive, and secondly, even if he did, the trauma would never allow him to relive these moments. Two youths pounced on him, jabbering excitedly in Swahili. A third youth darted into the forest in search of any accomplices. As the youths bound his ankles, Craig watched the tall man gulp down the German girl's blood. He drank so eagerly and with such vigorous relish, it was possible to believe he completely voided her body of all 9 pints. His cheeks had colored up, and Craig thought he could see a change in the man's body. It had filled out. The mosquitoes that clung to him no longer covered quite so much of his gray-white nakedness. He wondered when his own turn would come. Would the tall man save up his victims, drink them dry one a day, or would he binge? Already he had turned to Allison, swinging from her bonds as she tried desperately to free herself. She was a fighter. Karen sobbed uncontrollably alongside, and Leif was wherever he had gone to while they were all still on the boat. As Craig was hoisted upside down and secured by one of the youths, he thought to himself it would be preferable to go first. As if sensing his silent plea, the tall man twisted around to consider the attractions of his body over the girl's. Popo's approach was swift and silent. The first of any of those present knew of it was an abrupt cacophony, the crashing of bodies through dry vegetation, the deep-throated growling of hungry beasts, the concerted yells and screeches of our rescuers. Visually, I was aware of a black and gold blur, flashing ivory teeth and ropes of saliva swinging from heavy jaws as the leopards leapt. Popo, saved my life at that point, the exact moment at which the old Craig died. It was necessary if I were to survive. The hard-nosed journalist was as dead as the corpses swinging in the breeze higher up in the tree. He would not write up this story. I would. But not for a long time, and not for the newspapers. It's history now, become legend, myth, just as it had always been to Popo and the men of Jozani. Those who survived it, and they are few, speak of it rarely. Leif lives quietly on his own, in a house by the sea in his native Denmark. Karen, his former girlfriend, has returned to Africa as an aid worker. Most recently, she has been in eastern Zaire. I saw her interviewed on the TV news during the refugee crisis. I have no contact with either of them. Allison and I tried to remain in touch. A couple of letters exchanged, and we met once in a bar in the West End. But the lights and the noise upset us both, and we soon parted. I have no idea where she is now or what she is doing. I left my reporter's job on medical advice and spent some time fell walking in South Wales until I felt well enough to return to work, but on the production side this time. I never have to read the copy or look at the pictures. Just make sure the words are on the page and the colors are right. I go to Regent's Park Zoo every so often to look at the leopards. Watching them prowl around their cages reminds me of the moment in my life when I was most alive. When I saw, with an almost photographic clarity, one of Popo's leopards take a swipe with its heavy paw at the blood-sucking creature's midriff. There was an explosion, a shower of blood. Anna's blood. His skin flapped uselessly, transparently, like that of the mosquito I had swatted against my arm on the terrace of the Africa House Hotel. Popo and his men, witch doctors, or Jozani forest guides, I never found out, untied us and lowered us safely to the ground. Later that evening, after the police had been called and started the clear-up operation, Popo himself took me back to Zanzibar town in his Suzuki. On the outskirts of town, he brought the vehicle to a sudden halt, flapping his hand about his head as if trying to beat off an invisible foe. "What's up?" I asked, leaning towards him. "Mbo," he muttered. I heard a high-pitched whine as it passed by my ear. I, too, lashed out angrily. "Mosquito?" I asked. "Mbo," he nodded. It turned out I had got the little sod, despite my flailing attack. Maybe it was just stunned, but it lay in the palm of my hand. I was relieved to see that its body was empty of blood. "We call it mosquito," I said, and I shivered as I wondered if we had brought it from the forest on our clothes. For months later, I would discover mosquitoes, no more than half a dozen or so, among the clothes I had brought back from Zanzibar. So far, they have all been dead ones.
Beanbag Cats. Edward Bryant.
Edward Bryant began writing professionally in 1968 and has had more than a dozen books published, including Among the Dead, Cinnabar, Phoenix Without Ashes, with Harlan Ellison, Wyoming Sun, Particle Theory, Fetish, a novella chapbook, and The Baku, Tales of the Nuclear Age. He originally made a name for himself as an award-winning science fiction writer, but in the mid-1980s, he strayed into horror, where he produced a series of sharply etched stories about Angie Black, a contemporary witch. The brilliant zombie story, A Sad Last Love at the Diner of the Damned, and other marvelous tales. But he's never completely given up writing science fiction. Beanbag Cats, registered trademark, commissioned by me for Omni Magazine in 1983, is a little of both.
From John J. Finnegan, President, Wake and Finnegan, Marketing Division. To David Brooks, Head Copywriter, Creative Projects Department.
Okay, son, where is it? Life Pro Labs is getting a little antsy. They're laying out more cash for this campaign than you know. Show me something rough.
From Brooks to Finnegan.
You want it, boss? It's yours. It ain't been easy trying to figure out how to sell a pussy that looks like a strudel. Notes follow. A significant portion of the Beanbag Cat campaign will obviously be oriented toward urban consumers. A genetically modified, non-ambulatory pet will be very attractive to apartment, co-op, and condominium dwellers. Imagine the numerous possibilities for utilizing what is essentially a live cat without paws or legs. Standard accessory packs should include Velcro grip strips so that the beanbag cat can be placed securely on a sofa arm, chair seat, or any other surface in a limited living space. Models will initially include the 10 most popular feline breeds. BBCs will be available either in kitten or adult format, although the kittens will be hormonally arrested, so that they will stay cute for an indefinite product span. Item. LifePro Labs says they'll have the growth curve problem licked in a year or so, and then we'll be able to offer a BBC that the consumer can obtain as a kitten, and then be able to watch grow into adulthood in a matter of weeks. They'll simply have to change the Sanikit attachments. These can be marketed separately as an educational experience for children, emphasizing the lesson of pet care responsibility. About the Sanikits, since prospective consumers will obviously realize that the BBC won't be able to get to a sandbox on its own, or at least not at any practicable speed, the campaign will have to mention the Sanikit bags that the pet owner will be obliged to change at a maximum of 3-day intervals. There must be a marketable way to warn owners that failure to observe the maintenance schedule in the beanbag cat will result minimally in feline renal dysfunction, maximally in cat all over the living room. Perhaps research and development can come up with an audible warning such as the low battery indicator in home smoke alarms. Call them Sanicat kits, and LifePro Labs can look forward to a lucrative accessory trade. Emphasize in the campaign that beanbag cats will purr, lick, nibble, and squirm just like the original model, but they will not scratch furniture, chase birds, or wander around the neighborhood at night. From Finnegan to Brooks. Looks terrific so far. LPL should love it. One problem. Late word from the lab says there's a hitch in the DNA splicing for the kitties. First year's model run will have to be surgically modified from existing stock, so as to stay competitive in the marketplace. We'll need some glossing. Can do?
From Brooks to Finnegan.
No problem. Just like the suicide from drinking varnish. A horrible death, but a beautiful finish. By the by, what have you got for me after I finish pitching the beanbag cats?
From Finnegan to Brooks.
A treat. How do you feel about modular dogs?
Antiquities. John Crowley.
John Crowley was born in Maine, on a World War II airbase, grew up in Vermont, Kentucky, and Indiana, then went to live in New York City, where he worked on documentary and commercial films and began to write novels. He now lives in Massachusetts. He is the recipient of 3 World Fantasy Awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award, the Primo Flaiano Super Prize, and an award in literature from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. Prominent in his oeuvre are the novel Little Big and the 4-volume Egypt series. Other works include The Translator, and Lord Byron's novel, The Evening Land. His most recent novel, Four Freedoms, was published in 2009. Antiquities is in the tradition of the very popular science fiction, fantasy, and horror club or bar tale, that is, an improbable or ghostly story told around a fire in a gentleman's club or in a bar. Crowley reports that the central device of the story, the cat mummy mausoleum in Egypt, is actually real, and the story of how it came to England and was sold for fertilizer is also true. Antiquities, the oldest story, other than the Lewis Carroll excerpt, in this volume, was originally published in 1977 by Stuart David Schiff in his classic anthology series, Whispers. It seems dated not at all.
There was, of course, Sir Geoffrey said, the Unconstancy Plague in Cheshire. Short-lived, but a phenomena I don't think we can quite discount. It was quite late at the Travellers' Club, and Sir Geoffrey and I had been discussing, as we seemed often to do in those years of the Empire's greatest, yet somehow most tenuous extent, some anomalous eruptions of the foreign, and the odd into the home island's quiet life, small, unlooked-for effects, which those centuries of adventure and acquisition had had on an essentially stay-at-home race. At least that was my thought. I was quite young. "It's no good your saying, of course, in that off-hand tone," I said, attempting to catch the eye of Barnett, whom I felt as much as saw, passing through the crepuscular haze of the smoking room. "I've no idea what the Inconstancy Plague was." From within his evening dress, Sir Geoffrey drew out a cigar case, which faintly resembled a row of cigars, as a mummy case resembles the human form within. He offered me one, and we lit them without haste. Sir Geoffrey started a small vortex in his brandy glass. I understood that these rituals were introductory, that, in other words, I would have my tale. "It was in the latter 80s, Sir Geoffrey said. "I've no idea now how I first came to hear of it, though I shouldn't be surprised if it was some flippant note in Punch. I paid no attention at first. The popular delusions and madness of crowds sort of thing. I'd returned not long before from Ceylon, and was utterly blankly oppressed by the weather. It was just starting autumn when I came ashore, and I spent the next 4 months more or less behind closed doors. The rain, the fog, how could I have forgotten? And the oddest thing was that no one else seemed to pay the slightest attention. My man used to draw the drapes every morning, and say in the most cheerful voice, 'Another dismal wet one, eh, sir?' And I would positively turn my face to the wall." He seemed to sense that he had been diverted by personal memories, and drew on his cigar, as though it were the font of recall. "What brought it to notice was a seemingly ordinary murder case. A farmer's wife in Winsford, married some decades, came one night into the Sheaf of Wheat, a public house, where her husband was lingering over a pint. From under her skirt she drew an old fowling piece. She made a remark which was later reported quite variously by the onlookers, and gave him both barrels. One misfired, but the other was quite sufficient. We learn that the husband, on seeing this about to happen, seemed to show neither surprise nor anguish, merely looking up and, well, awaiting his fate. At the inquest, the witnesses reported the murderess to have said, before she fired, 'I'm doing this in the name of all the others,' or perhaps it was, 'I'm doing this, Sam, his name, to save the others,' or possibly, 'I've got to do this, Sam, to save you from that other.' The woman seemed to have gone quite mad. She gave the investigators an elaborate and scarifying story which they, unfortunately, didn't take down, being able to make no sense of it. The rational gist of it was that she had shot her husband for flagrant infidelities, which she could bear no longer. When the magistrate asked witnesses if they knew of such infidelities, these things, in a small community being notoriously difficult to hide, the men, as a body, claimed that they did not. After the trial, however, the women had dark and unspecific hints to make, how they could say much if they would, and so on. The murderess was adjudged unfit to stand trial, and hanged herself in Bedlam not long after. I don't know how familiar you are with that oppressive part of the world. In those years, Farming was a difficult enterprise at best. Isolating, stultifyingly boring, unremunerative. Hired men were heavy drinkers. Prices were depressed. The women aged quickly, what with continual childbirth, added to a load of work at least equal to their menfolks. What I'm getting at is that it is, or was, a society the least of any conducive to adultery, amour, romance. And yet for some reason it appeared, after this murder pointed it up, so to speak, dramatically, that there was a veritable plague of inconstant husbands in northern Cheshire. It's difficult to imagine, I said, what evidence there could be of such a thing. I had occasion to go to the country that autumn, just at the height of it all, Sir Geoffrey went on, caressing an ashtray with the tip of his cigar. I'd at last got a grip on myself, and begun to accept invitations again. A fellow I'd known in Alexandria, a commercial agent, who'd done spectacularly well for himself, asked me up for the shooting. Odd place to go shooting. Odd fellow. Arrivist, to speak frankly. The hospitality was lavish. The house was a red-brick Cheshire faux Gothic affair, if you know what I mean, and the impression it gave of desolation and melancholy was remarkable, and there was no shooting. Poured rain all weekend. One set about leafing through novels or playing Cairo whist, which is what we called bridge in those days, and staring out the windows. One evening, at a loss for entertainment, our host, what was his name and... What was his name? I asked. Exactly. He'd become a student of mesmerism, or hypnotism, as he preferred to call it, and suggested we might have a bit of fun probing our dark underminds. We all declined, but Watt was insistent, and at last suborned a hearty local type, old Squire Ochiel family, and, this is important, an inveterate, dirt-under-the-nails farmer. His conversation revolved chiefly around turnips. Even his dark underminds? Ah, here we come to it. This gentleman's wife was present at the gatherings as well, and one couldn't help noticing the hangdog air he maintained around her, the shifty eyes, the nervous start he gave when she spoke to him from behind, and also a certain dreaminess, an abstraction, that would fall on him at odd moments. Worrying about his turnips, perhaps. Sir Geoffrey quashed his cigar, rather reproachfully, as though it were my own flippancy. The point is that this ruddy-faced, absolutely ordinary fellow was cheating on his wife. One read it as though it were written on his shirt front. His wife seemed quite aware of it as any. Her face was drawn tight as her reticule. She blanched when he agreed to go under, and tried to lead him away, but Watt insisted he be a sport, and at last she retired with a headache. I don't know what the man was thinking of when he agreed. He had a bit too much brandy, I expect. At any rate, the lamps were lowered and the usual apparatus got out, the spinning disc and so on. The squire, to Watt's surprise, went under as though slain. We thought at first he had merely succumbed to the grape, but then Watt began to question him, and he to answer, languidly but clearly, name, age, and so on. I've no doubt Watt intended to have the man stand on his head, or turn his waistcoat back to front, or that sort of thing. But before any of that could begin, the man began to speak, to address someone. Someone female. Most extraordinary, the way he was transformed. Sir Geoffrey, in the proper mood, shows a talent for mimicry, and now he seemed to transform himself into the hypnotized squire. His eyes glazed and half-closed. His mouth went slack, though his moustache remained upright, and one hand was raised as though to ward off an importunate spirit.
No, says he. Leave me alone. Close those eyes. Those eyes. Why? Why? Dress yourself. Oh, God!
And here he seemed quite in torment. Watt should, of course, have awakened the poor fellow immediately, but he was fascinated, as I confess we all were. "Who is it you speak to?" Watt asked.
"She," says the squire. "The foreign woman. The clawed woman. The cat."
"What is her name?"
"Bastet."
"How did she come here?" At this question the squire seemed to pause. Then he gave three answers.
"Through the earth. By default. On the John Deering."
This last answer astonished Watt, since, as he told me later, the John Deering was a cargo ship we had often dealt with,
which made a regular Alexandria-Liverpool run. "Where do you see her?" Watt asked. "In the sheaves of wheat."
He meant the pub, I suppose, I put in.
"I think not," Sir Geoffrey said darkly. He went on about the sheaves of wheat. He grew more animated, though it was more difficult to understand his words. He began to make sounds. Well, how shall I put it? His breathing became stertorous. His movements. I think I see. Well, you can't quite, because it was one of the more remarkable things I have ever witnessed. The man was making physical love to someone he described as a cat, or a sheaf of wheat. "The name he spoke," I said, "is an Egyptian one, a goddess associated with the cat." "Precisely. It was midway through this ritual that Watt at last found himself, and gave an awakening command. The fellow seemed dazed, and was quite drenched with sweat. His hand shook when he took out his pocket handkerchief to mop his face. He looked at once guilty and pleased, like the cat who ate the canary. You have a talent for simile. He looked around at the company, and asked shyly if he had embarrassed himself. I tell you, old boy, we were hard-pressed to reassure him. Unsummoned, Barnett materialized behind us, with the air of one about to speak tragic and ineluctable prophecies. It is his usual face. He said only that it had begun to rain. I asked for a whiskey and soda. Sir Geoffrey seemed lost in thought during these transactions, and when he spoke again it was to muse. "Odd, isn't it?" he said. "How naturally one thinks of cats as female, though we know quite well that they are distributed between two sexes. As far as I know, it is the same the world over. Whenever, for instance, a cat in a tail is transformed into a human, it is invariably a woman." "The eyes," I said, "the movements, that certain sinuosity." "The air of independence," Sir Geoffrey said. "False, of course. One's cat is quite dependent to one, though he seems not to think so. The capacity for ease. And spite." "To return to our plague," I said, "I don't see how a single mad woman and a hypnotized squire amount to one."
"Oh, that was by no means the end of it. Throughout that autumn there was, relatively speaking, a flurry of divorce actions and breach of promise suits. A suicide left a note. I can't have her, and I can't live without her. More than one farmer's wife, after years of dedication and many offspring, packed herself off to aged parents in Chester, and so on. Monday morning, after the squire's humiliation, I returned to town. As it happened, Monday was market day in the village, and I was able to observe at first hand some effects of the plague. I saw husbands and wives sitting at far ends of wagon seats, unable to meet each other's eyes, sudden arguments flaring without reason over the vegetables. I saw tears. I saw over and over the same hangdog, evasive, guilty look I described in our squire. Hardly conclusive. There is one further piece of evidence. The Roman Church has never quite eased its grip in that part of the world. It seems that about this time a number of R.C. wives clubbed together and sent a petition to their bishop, saying that the region was in need of an exorcism. Specifically, that their husbands were being tormented by a succubus, or succubi. Whether it was one or many was impossible to tell. I shouldn't wonder. What specifically intrigued me, Sir Geoffrey went on, removing his eyeglass from between cheek and brow and polishing it absently, is that in all this inconstancy, only the men seemed to be accused. The women seemed sorely aggrieved, rather than guilty parties. Now, if we take the squire's words as evidence, and not merely the stuff that dreams are made on, we have the picture of a foreign, apparently Egyptian woman, or possibly women, embarking at Liverpool, and moving unnoticed amid Cheshire, seeking whom she may devour, and seducing yeomen in their barns amid the fruits of the harvest. The notion was so striking that I got in touch with a chap at Lloyd's and asked him about passenger lists from the John Deering over the last few years. And? There were none. The ship had been in dry dock for 2 or 3 years previous. It had made one run that spring, and then been mothballed. On that one run there were no passengers. The cargo from Alex consisted of the usual oil, dates, sago, rice, tobacco, and something called antiquities. Since the nature of these was unspecified, the matter ended there. The inconstancy plague was short-lived. A letter from Watt the next spring made no mention of it, though he'd been avid for details. Most of what I know comes from him and his gleanings of the Winsford Trumpet, or whatever it calls itself. I might never have come to any conclusion at all about the matter, had it not been for a chance encounter in Cairo a year or so later. I was en route to the Sudan, in the wake of the Khartoum disaster, and was bracing myself, so to speak, in the bar of Shepherds. I struck up a conversation with an archaeologist fellow, just off a dig around Memphis, and the talk turned, naturally, to Egyptian mysteries. The thing that continually astonished him, he said, was the absolute thoroughness of the ancient Egyptian mind. Once having decided a thing was ritualistically necessary, they admitted of no deviation in carrying it out. He instanced cats. We know in what high esteem the Egyptians held cats. If held in high esteem, they must be mummified after death, and so they were, all of them, or nearly all, carried to their tombs, with the bereaved family weeping behind, put away with favorite toys and food for the afterlife journey. Not long ago, he said, some 300,000 mummified cats were uncovered at Beni Hassan, an entire cat necropolis, unviolated for centuries. And then he told me something which gave me pause, more than pause. He said that, once uncovered, all those cats were disinterred and shipped to England, every last one. Good Lord, why? I have no idea. They were not, after all, the Elgin marbles. This seemed to have been the response when they arrived at Liverpool, because not a single museum or collector of antiquities displayed the slightest interest. The whole lot had to be sold off,